Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk show. My name's David Inge. Glad to have you with us. The topic this time here in this first hour is children's health, something that we do every month, always on a Thursday, and with the guy who's here with me right now. His name is Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician. He's been stopping by regularly for quite a few years now to do this program. And many years ago, when we started thinking about what would be good topics for Focus, we thought, well, probably people would always have questions about children's health, and it would be a good thing to do every month. And that's why we're here. Anything that you might think of asking a pediatrician, we've talked about a lot of different sorts of things, about development kind of issues, certainly about many health questions, and behavioral issues we've talked about, a lot of different sorts of things. Anything that you could imagine asking a pediatrician, that's certainly fair on this program, and I know that the doctor will do his best to give you an answer. Here in Champaign-Urbana, if you'd like to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, so that if it would be a long-distance call, use that number, and that's 800-222-9455. 333-WILL and toll-free, 800-222-WILL. Welcome back.
Well, good morning. It's good to be here.
Oh, we're glad to have you. One more time, you say we'll tell people about flu shots, and then we'll leave them alone.
Last time I will nag in 2003. Hopefully, we'll be back in 2004 to nag again. But yeah, mm-hmm. I saw a report that influenza is being reported in the mm-hmm. United States. They say it's going to be a bad year. I don't know about. I don't think anybody's fortune or crystal ball works that well. Mm-hmm. But the flu shot is available. It's a good vaccine. Anyone over 6 months of age is welcome to it. And avoid the flu if you can, and that's the best way to do it.
I thought that I heard some speculation that the way this works is that the people who make up the vaccine look out there in the world, they look at the strains of flu, because there are a number of them, and they make a kind of educated guess as to which are the ones that will come across, and that they put those into the vaccine. So, and I think that I heard a news item saying something to the effect that they think, well, maybe they didn't pick the right ones. So I suppose that's still, you should still go out and get the flu shot and cross your fingers.
Yes. And this is the best guess, and scientific guess, but they're guessing what's going to be around this year, and they're usually right, but still the best we can do to try and prevent influenza, yeah. A and B. Or yeah, whatever they think is going to come around this year, and again, if you had a flu shot last year, you need a flu shot again this year, because again they think the antigenic strains changed, and last year's vaccine won't protect us against this year's disease. And like you said, maybe it won't protect us against this year's disease if they guessed wrong. But still, it's the best we can do, and it's, I think it's a good deal. And most of the insurance companies love to pay for it, because it's far less expensive for them to pay for prevention than to pay for hospitalizations. And influenza causes or contributes to a significant amount of deaths in the United States every year. And we've spent a lot of time worrying about West Nile virus and other things that happen kind of infrequently. And this thing's influenza is, it's kind of a nasty bug. And if you can keep from getting it, do so, and that's the influenza vaccine.
All right, and just again, the bottom line for people is it's not too late.
No.
But the longer you wait, the more chance is that even if you get the shot, it takes little time for the immunity to kick in, and if you should happen to be exposed to the flu bug before it does, then it's not going to do what you want it to do.
Yes, and it probably takes about a week for the vaccine to kick up your antibody titers.
One of the things we talked about, I think when you were here last, is a new kind of delivery system for the vaccine that gets around the need for the needle stick, which some people find unpleasant. And this was a kind of a mist, and what you do is you shoot it into the nose. And it seems that it just hasn't quite caught on.
I think it is a live viral vaccine. It's an attenuated virus, so it can cause some illness, and it could be possibly dangerous for people with immune system problems, like, oh, if you're being treated for cancer or something like that, you're on medications that will reduce your immune system. So it could potentially be hazardous that way. It's approved from age 6 to age 50-something, I think. So that leaves out the very young and the very old that can't get it. And it sounds like its only advantage is you may avoid a needle. You'll avoid an injection needle stick. I don't know what the cost of that is compared to the current vaccine widely used, and it just seems to, it seems to be a good idea. It just needs to be worked on a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, we have a caller ready to talk with, and anybody else who's listening, if you have a question for our guest, Dr. Robert Bocek here, we're talking about children's health. We do it every month on a Thursday. Whatever questions you have, you give us a call, 333-9455. That's for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have caller in Aurora to talk with on our line 4. Hello.
Well, Dr. Bocek.
Good morning.
Wanted to tell you, my daughter just called to tell me that she did. It's so ironic that you should be on in that phone call come not 10 minutes ago to tell me she did get sole guardianship of that child that I spoke to you about last month.
Okay.
And I just wanted to ask, I did give her that list of different things that she should work on. I don't know if she used it, but now that it's to this stage, is there anything new that you could say to me and to my daughter about what we could do? The child is charming. Charming child.
I think the most that, I think now it's a question of hold on and see what, and I hope everything goes well, and I hope this was a very wise decision. But I think that, I think there are going to be some, problems, some adjustments to the new family structure, and hopefully they will be minor and they will be easily solvable. And I think right now it's just kind of take it day by day and see what happens.
I'm a very over-enthusiastic person, and I think I have to curb my enthusiasm because I kind of was where that child is, and I know what it was. So I guess I'll tell myself to, just be a good listener and give her the empathic response.
I think you're one of the advantages that this child has, the supportive extended family. And I think you're one of the, one of the great advantages this child has. Excuse me. With what's going to happen and the changes that are going to be made. And I think you're going to be a great support.
Well, and isn't it good that I know somehow, I can't say I know exactly, but I know somehow what she's going through.
Yes.
And, let me say this. Despite what her mother did to her when she was 3 years old, almost killed her, the child still puts her mother and father's, and the father that won't support her, puts the mother and father's picture up in the new room she has in my daughter's home, despite all that. So you know how important parents are to a child.
Absolutely. This really doesn't make any sense, does it? I mean, one would think that she would be very angry and want to disown her mother and father, but that's not the way it works.
It doesn't. And I have a list of things that I took down from Dr. Phil's program about a child of divorce and what happens. And one of the things it says that a child is sad, a child is grieving, that somebody is always missing, And that one that states somebody is always missing is the one that hits me the hardest. That somebody is always missing, either the father or the mother in this child's life. Thank God they have a lot of animals in the house for any kind of emotional stimulation they need in comforting the animals and being with the animals. And I'll report to you, and I'll tell you how it's going along. And I thank you for your words. That list you gave me last month was better than the Bible. Thank you much.
I appreciate being included in your family. Thank you.
Well, thank you for
thank
the call.
Thank you, and a happy Thanksgiving.
Well, you too.
Bye-bye.
Well, again, here this morning on Focus, our guest is Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician. He is on the program every month, and we've been doing that for a long time, to give you a regular opportunity to talk about children's health. And if you have questions about the kids in your life, you can give us a call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line. That one's good. Anywhere you can hear us. And that is 800-222-9455.
The American Academy of Pediatrics, you may have heard, recently changed their recommendation on poison treatment. And sirup ipecac is a no-no now. Why is it suddenly a no? What did sirup of ipecac do? It made
makes you throw up.
Makes you throw up. Rather, it will within 30 minutes. It will evacuate the stomach. So why isn't that a good thing to do if somebody's ingested something? And I think the major it's still under certain circumstances. It still may be a good thing to do. If you know that within the last 5 minutes they ingested a bottle of something that can be toxic, maybe it would be a good thing to give them Ipecac right away. But I think what the new recommendation is saying is don't make that judgment yourself. Consult a physician. Consult, maybe better yet, your local poison control, because the other thing that's very popular and very very worthwhile doing is giving activated charcoal. And what is activated charcoal? It's charcoal that's been just ground into a super fine powder, so it adsorbs toxins, adsorbs a lot of stuff, and often it'll be teamed up with something to cause a little bit of increased intestinal transit. So they'll give a non-absorbable sugar or something like that to cause a little diarrhea, if you will, to speed the evacuation of things. And if you don't know how long something, the other problem with sirup of ipecac is the nausea after sirup of ipecac may last half hour to an hour. So that means that you really can't give the activated charcoal because it's probably going to be thrown up too. And also some poisons, like particularly the drain cleaners, the lye, they burn on the way down, so you don't want to cause vomiting because then it'll burn on the way up again. And if something's been down long enough, maybe you'd want to use the activated charcoal and something to cause an increased intestinal transit time to flush it, to adsorb it so it won't be absorbed from the intestine, and flush it on through faster. So yeah, sirup of ipecac is still useful, but should be used. It shouldn't be probably the first thing you grab when somebody's ingested something. Probably the telephone with the 800 number poison control is the first thing to grab to find out if ipecac would be the most important thing to do, or maybe you don't need to do anything, or maybe another treatment. Like activated charcoal or something like that would be more appropriate. So it's still a good drug. They're talking about putting it on prescription only, so it won't be used inappropriately. But it's still good. But it's not the first thing you reach for when somebody ingests something that could be harmful or toxic.
So the activated charcoal, is that something that you could just go into the wherever you shop or go into the drugstore and find on the shelf?
Yeah, or, I don't know. I expect you can, I think that still the message that I want you to be left with is
get advice.
Call poison control first.
Okay.
And find out what the best treatment is, because activated charcoal is available. All the emergency rooms have that.
Okay.
And it's tasteless, and except it's not well accepted because who wants to drink this black liquid stuff?
But you actually have to drink it?
You
in
have
a,
to
a liquid
it.
Form. So it sounds like it's probably not all that pleasant, but I guess if you the alternative is
it's quite tasteless. And now, and the other advantage of mixing it with a non-absorbable sugar is it flavors it. It gives it a sweeter flavor and makes it more palatable. And often what they're doing with poisoning now is maybe they'll give you a dose of activated charcoal every hour and just absorb everything that's in the intestine. Yeah.
I guess some people may, you know, I might think that your first thought might be to, that what you want to do is both try to get it flushed out and try to dilute it. So I would think, well, I would just have the person drink as much water as they could possibly hold. Would that actually make sense?
Yes. But yes and no, because it's still in the intestine in an absorbable form. So you want to attach it to this charcoal, which isn't absorbable, and it just gets passed out.
Whatever you do, you want to do so, the minimize the possibility that whatever it is, it's actually going to be absorbed.
Yeah.
It's going to be get into the body.
Leave it in the intestine. Just attach it to something that makes it non-absorbable.
Right. Okay. Again, questions here, welcome. Our guest is Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician. He's with us every month, always on Thursday. We talk about children's health, and if you have questions, whatever's on your mind about children and their health, well-being, development, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. A little bit earlier, we were talking about flu. We know this is the season. We're coming into the season. And the recommendation is obviously for just about everybody to have the shot. And it'll increase the chances that you'll get through being well. It seemed that last year in the fall and into the winter, we had some particularly nasty intestinal viruses. And I guess I assume that they were viruses going around that were giving a lot of people some pretty nasty vomiting and diarrhea and just basically knocking them out for a period of days. I mean, it was nasty. I encountered one of these things myself Thanksgiving last year, and I would say I haven't been that, I can't remember ever having been that sick. It was really bad. So it's the kind of thing that I would like not to have to experience again. And I don't know if that's just the kind of thing that periodically it's going to be around and it's going to be out there, and that there's probably not a whole lot you can do other than the usual kinds of things that we always tell people: wash your hands, especially after you've been in a bathroom, and you know that's about what you can do.
Yeah, I think there's you know, we've got the flu shot, we can prevent that. We've got the routine immunizations for children, so we can prevent chicken pox and measles and mumps and rubella and whooping cough and all that sort of stuff. And but there's a lot of things we can't, and I think these are the kind of viruses we're talking about that have hit the cruise ships recently, and that there's probably been some contamination of the water supply, or it's person to person, and yeah, there's nothing you can do to prevent these things. You just take care of them. Yeah, wash your hands. I still think Americans need to give up handshaking, and we need to get into the Japanese habit of bowing to one another or something, but person-to-person contact, and yeah, wash your hands after using the toilet facilities. Person-to-person contact, you know, if something's running around, sort of minimize it. Actual physical contact, and don't. Yeah, fellowship is important, but the skin-to-skin contact is what causes the problem.
Okay, more than the fact that it might be on some surface that you would touch, and then you would get it that way.
Yeah, probably a lot of our bacteria and viruses, if it's on a dry surface, they usually don't survive very long. Respiratory syncytial virus is an exception to that. That will live on this tabletop for hours and be transmissible. But for the most part, what we call fomites, surfaces and toys and that sort of thing, aren't particularly good disease spreaders once the secretion is dried up.
Okay. All right. We have a caller here in to talk with in Bloomington, Illinois. Let's do that on our toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, hello. This is Bob in Bloomington. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm in my car on a cell phone, so I'll just ask a quick question and then hang up and listen. I have a 7-year-old daughter, and her dentist is saying that he thinks some of her teeth ought to be pulled because some are growing in behind others, and he thinks that there needs to be some room. He needs to make some room for the others to grow in. And her mother and I are kind of, well, does she need to be put to sleep, you know, to do this at this age? Or will they, if she's going to have braces, can we just wait and do it later? And so we've got reservations about doing it, and I'd just like your opinion on that. Thank you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. These are probably mostly, yeah, he's probably talking about sort of early removal of deciduous teeth. To allow room for the permanent teeth to come in. And this, you know, I presume he's got good credentials. I presume you trust him. He's probably right. To make more room for the permanent teeth to come in, and it may save some, it may minimize the orthodontic work to a certain extent. And I don't know, when's Dr. Sabia going to be on again? This is
a little bit
out of my field, but generally that is done to make room in the dental arch for the permanent teeth to come in, and it may preserve the dental arch and minimize the amount of orthodontic care that's needed later.
What do you think about the question of anesthesia, either general or local?
You know, I think that very much depends on the child. I think very often, if these are deciduous teeth, they probably don't, and she's age 7, they're probably, the root structure is beginning to be absorbed. And it may be that little local anesthetic will be appropriate. It may be that a little oral sedation, just the oral medication, just to kind of make her a little sleepy. Maybe that, maybe a little gas anesthetic like nitrous oxide might do it. Or it may be that, yeah, that she will need a full general anesthetic. But I would guess that probably something less than a full general anesthetic would probably be successful here.
What's the recommendations about when a child should see the dentist, or the dentist should see a child for the first time?
Okay. Age 3 is the general rule. Why is 3 picked? Or when should you start taking care of teeth? And there's talk about, you know, maybe when you bring the baby home, you ought to start massaging the gums with a gauze or a cloth of some kind, and get them into brushing as, you know, as soon as teeth erupt, with a very soft brush, and probably a fluoride-free toothpaste. And I understand they do make those now for child use. And the first dental visit would be at age 3. Why did the dentist pick age 3? Because that's probably the earliest age you can, that these children will cooperate with you. You know, the 18-month-old probably isn't going to cooperate with you very much. And I think there is a, you know, there was a recent article published about the general use of fluoride, and I think the concern is we used to throw fluoride around in bigger doses much more frequently, and the concern is now that there's a lot of fluoride in our food sources, in the prepared food, canned food and that sort of thing. So the recent recommendation is, and 60% of the population in the United States or something like that has a fluoridated water supply. And I think there's no doubt that fluoride does reduce dental caries, but it may do so at the expense of dental fluorosis. And dental fluorosis, you'll see people with very white spots in their teeth, and that's probably dental fluorosis. And it's cosmetically unsatisfactory. We aren't supposed to have pure white teeth, snow white teeth. We have, yeah, our teeth are a variety of colors. And to have these pure white speckles in the teeth is a little bit cosmetically unsatisfactory. And also, if there's enough, a little bit, the right amount of fluoride incorporated into the enamel as it develops is good. Too much fluoride apparently weakens the enamel, and it's more subject to tooth decay. So I think the ardor for fluoride supplements is cooling a bit, and I think it seems to be increasing for topical fluoride treatments as done by a dentist. And so, yeah, that's good, but the the concern is more with the amount of fluoride that's ingested in our food sources and in toothpaste, because toothpastes are designed to taste good, so kids tend to swallow them. And so when you start your child brushing, if you're using a fluoridated toothpaste, make sure that they're old enough to spit it out and rinse their mouth and spit it out and not ingest it. Because, yeah, fluoride seems that with all our sources of fluoride in the food, we're probably safer and maybe better treatment for topical fluoride than ingested fluoride. Yeah, you want to be careful about how much fluoride is ingested by children, because it can cause dental problems.
Yeah. So one of the things that's really something that's available today that was not when either you or I were kids are the sealants that some of the dentists can use, which seems to me to be a nice idea, where they can apply something to the flat surfaces of the teeth, which are the places that most of the cavities do happen, that will effectively make a barrier there between the food that causes the problem and the enamel, so that you can that way, and certainly for some people the issue would be, could you afford to have it done, because the dentist is going to charge you money to do it, but that in the long run it might mean that that child will have fewer cavities. So, you know, maybe you think about the cost of the dental care, maybe it's a good trade-off, and that is something that certainly people can think about and talk about with whoever provides their dental care.
And it fills in the little cracks and crevices and stuff, the little microscopic things where stuff collects. Mm-hmm. I guess they aren't microscopic, but there's some things we can't see, and just keeps down the collection. And again, dental caries is a bacterial disease. The bacteria live on the stuff that accumulates in our mouth and form the plaque, and then they create acids and it eats away the enamel. But again, we don't want to use antibiotics for that.
Questions again are welcome here. We're about midway through this part of Focus 580 with our guest, Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician and is on the program once a month. We do this show to give you a regular opportunity to ask questions about children's health. So whatever is on your mind, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Maybe just one more thing that I'm sure our friends, the dentists, would appreciate to mention, that for anybody who might think that it was not that important to take care of the deciduous teeth, that is the teeth that they're going to fall out, the baby teeth, they would say, no, don't think that because they're going to fall out, it means that it doesn't matter, that you don't have to take care of them, that you don't have to pay attention to dental health for those younger children, because you do. And you don't want cavities in that teeth. You don't want them to develop dental problems then, because if they have problems then those problems are just going to get carried on later on.
Yeah, they preserve the dental arch. And so, if you lose a tooth too early, then maybe the arch will collapse, and then the permanent dentition it's going to come in out of the line, and that can create jaw problems. And I mean, orthodontists, are they cosmetic? Well, yeah, it's nice to have a pretty smile, but I think it's more important than that. Or there's another reason for it. It does preserve the dental arch. It preserves the bite, and may prevent problems with temporal mandibular joint dysfunction. And it's just, in addition to the pretty smile, mm-hmm. there's another reason you're spending $3,000 or whatever it is to preserve your child's dental arch.
Yeah. Well, what else is on your mind here this time around? Anything in particular?
What's happening out there? All the kids behaving? Everybody doing well in school? I'm glad. We said you can prevent flu by getting the flu vaccine. All right, but that's just a minor percentage of the viruses that we're exposed to in the year, during the year. What can we do when your child gets a cold? Get them a box of Kleenex. Give them some acetaminophen or ibuprofen if they have a fever. What are we doing with that? Is fever an enemy? No, fever is probably our friend. It probably tunes up nonspecific parts of our immune system and helps us fight infections more. So I think what we're doing with fever is we're just trying to not make it go away so much as we're just trying to reduce some of the things that go along with fever, the aches and pains, the feeling crummy, because you know that fluids are important when you're ill, too. You don't want to get dehydrated. So a little bit of acetaminophen or ibuprofen will help this child feel a little bit more comfortable. Hopefully will make him want to drink a little bit more and keep their fluid intake up. And so it's probably a good thing. How about rest? Well, you know, if they feel like resting, they ought to rest. But I think it's a battle not worth fighting to make them stay in bed if they're feeling good and don't want to stay in bed. So I think I'd keep them in the house so they don't spread this virus to all their friends and neighbors, although it's probably going around, so it's probably too late once they get it. But I think it is worthwhile keeping them in. Don't send them to school, please, if they have... Well, I don't know. This is a harder one to answer. When do you keep a child home from school?
Yeah.
I think certainly any kid with a fever is going to be feeling too rotten to get anything out of going to school. So I think they ought to stay home. And I think that's the judgment. If they have a runny nose, well, most of the kids in school probably have a runny nose with them. Send them to school. So I think it's, you know, if they're feeling good enough to get something out of school, send them to school. In your judgment, if they're feeling too rotten that they ought to stay home and just kind of cool it, keep them home. And that's a little nastier virus. Their classmates don't need it. Mm. And keep them home. What can you do about diarrhea again? Diarrhea and vomiting. Again, fluids are probably the most important thing there. We're looking to prevent dehydration, so kind of keep them sipping. What works well? Certainly Pedialyte and those things work well, or they're designed for this. Unfortunately, older kids, the palatability is a little bit less than desirable, and Gatorade and some of the sports drinks they're pretty good for it, too. If the baby is breastfeeding, recommendations are continue breastfeeding through vomiting and diarrhea. But just do the best you can to keep your child comfortable. Let them eat or drink whatever they want, but certainly do encourage them to take fluids in. And this too shall pass. And usually in about 2 or 3 days, they'll be feeling better and go back about their business.
When kids have colds, they, before the symptoms become really obvious, they're going to be capable of passing it on.
Yeah.
So there's going to be a window there where they're going to be little spreaders of infection, and you won't maybe not really realize that they have a cold. And then it may also be that in the later phases, they're still going to be symptomatic, but maybe not shedding so much virus. Once it becomes perfectly obvious that they have a cold and they have the symptoms, is there a way of knowing when exactly they still may be sneezing and sniffling and coughing and having runny nose and all that kind of stuff that says cold, but that they're not really going to be infectious anymore?
Yeah. Probably as long as they have any symptoms, they're infectious.
Well, okay.
But certainly, like we do well know with chickenpox, that they're probably most infectious the day before they break out with the rash.
Yeah.
And then the infectiousness, the titers of viruses sheds, goes down rapidly, and they're less contagious, although they're still contagious until the last lesion crusts over. And unfortunately, you'd have to go through this with each and every virus out there. And since, I mean, chickenpox, when a child breaks out with chickenpox, it's usually clear that they've got chickenpox. With a cold, there are several viruses that can cause a cold, so you need to, do viral testing. By the time you get the viral testing results back, it's child's well, or they're into their second cold or whatever, and so it's just not practical to do. And I think that's why we have trouble intervening and stopping an epidemic of a viral illness, because, again, like you say, they're contagious before they have any symptoms, so they're in school shedding it and giving it to their classmates, or at work giving it to their workmates before they have any symptoms or before they're feeling bad enough to stay home. And that's why the winter epidemics just go around and we can't intervene.
Yeah. Questions are welcome here. I mention once again, our guest is Dr. Robert Bocek. He's a pediatrician. He's with us every month. Always on Thursday, we talk about children's health. And if you have questions about dealing with diseases or behavioral issues or development questions, anything that you could think of talking about with the pediatrician, well, you're welcome to give us a call here on the program, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. So any point here, you can give us a call. I think we have a couple of people getting lined up, and we probably have about 12 minutes left on the program, so we'll get as many callers as we can, and the next caller here is in Normal on our toll-free line.
Hello.
Yes.
I have recently married, later in life, about 42, and I have a grandchild coming, and I wanted to, like, put a package together, like, for medicines or treatments for a newborn. What would you suggest, you know, to have in the medicine cabinet in case something comes along?
For a brand new newborn?
Yeah.
Maybe some acetaminophen.
Okay.
Or ibuprofen, Tylenol or Advil.
Okay.
And maybe some A&D ointment or something like that for diaper rash.
For a rash, okay.
And for a newborn, I think that's absolutely all I'd put in.
Okay. You were saying that the Ipecac? Yeah, that...
Super Vipecac.
Not recommended.
Again, I wouldn't put that in, particularly since you're in Bloomington. You know, you've got adequate medical care close by, good medical care close by. If something comes up, call poison control, and they'll advise you what and if to do. And, yeah, syrup of Ipecac. Again, I heard may go on prescription only, so it won't be available like it is now at the, you know, now you just go to the drugstore and say, hey, I want a bottle of syrup of Ipecac. That may be ceasing.
So, but you're saying the activated charcoal might be a better emergency treatment for, you know, if the they get into something they shouldn't get into.
Yeah.
Some kind of...
But again, I don't think that's something you'd need to have in your home medicine cabinet.
Okay. Well, I appreciate your advice.
You're welcome. Right,
thanks for the call. It's probably also for somebody like that, I would think that one of these is when this child gets big enough to walk, and if they're going to come visit the grandparents, and if you live in a house and have never really thought about childproofing your house, now there's something that you really want to think about, because there are all sorts of things at their level that may be problematic you don't want them to get into that you don't think about if you don't have small children and have never had small children in your house.
And where the, you know, everybody thinks of the medicine cabinet right away. Yeah, and I guess the other place I'd like to suggest is after you get done with your medicine cabinet, making sure that's secure, check under the kitchen sink, because that's where we tend to keep the drain cleaners and the other stuff, and the garage or the basement or garages where we keep the paint thinners and all those sorts of things, and keep those secure. And, you know, can you childproof a house? Well, you can try. But children are very inventive, and so I think, childproof as much as you can. Good child supervision. Keep an eye on them. If you don't know what they're up to, go find them. Because they're not mean or bad, but they're curious.
They're very curious. That's right.
And how about childproof lids? Who do they work for? They work best to keep adults out. But for the most part, they haven't been terribly successful about keeping children out of, especially on medicines, the childproof lids on medicine bottles and that sort of thing. They haven't been terribly successful.
Amen. So just make sure that, try and put it someplace where they are not going to be able to get at it. Next caller here is Charleston, line one. Hello.
Hi. You mentioned the flu shot, and I had a couple questions about that. As I understand, it is a dead virus?
Yes.
Okay. And is it therefore not possible to get the flu from it?
No, it is not possible. You may get some side effects from the vaccine, but they're going to be side effects, the same side effects you'd see if you got an injection of saline. So you're going to get local side effects. It comes on the end of a needle. It violates your skin, so it may hurt. And plus a half a cc is injected on the skin, so there may be local soreness, but you cannot get any disease from the vaccine itself.
Okay, and I've understood that you're not supposed to get the flu shot if you currently have the flu. Why is that?
You know, that's kind of, well, it's not going to do you any harm to get the flu shot while you have the flu. And I guess the only reason I can think is when you have the flu, your immune system may be already occupied, so the vaccine may not be quite as effective. But for the most part, the standard dictum now with children is go ahead and immunize them. If they're due for an immunization, for the most part, irregardless of whether they have a cold, cough, fever on at the same time. So, obviously, if you know you have influenza, yeah, I wouldn't bother to get the flu shot either because it's too late now. But I think, like we've already discussed, do you know that fever, achy stuff you've got now is influenza or is it adenovirus or one of the other viruses on there? So, you know, I'd say if you've got a cold or something like that, go ahead and get, and you're up for the flu shot, or there's a flu clinic going on, go ahead and get the flu shot.
Okay. I had another comment, too. It was based on the first caller's comments about the child, and she talked about divorce and how divorce affects children, and certainly does, and certainly the child is grieving. But I also wanted to point out that we have good research now that indicates that if parents are very unhappy, if they have open conflict, I'm not talking violent conflict at all, but if they are constantly fighting with one another, it's an open kind of chronic conflictive situation in the home, evidence indicates that that is more damaging to the child than if the parents divorce. Of course, it depends on how well they continue to co-parent. But I just didn't want to leave people with the notion that, gosh, getting divorced is the worst thing that can happen to the child. That's not the case. It's much worse to live together unhappily with open chronic conflict in the home between parents, because the kids are learning a model of what marriage and romantic relationships are about, as well as how to express negative emotion and all of those things. And it ends up being more damaging to them in the long run than a divorce well handled, at any rate.
Yeah, it is making the best of a bad situation, isn't it?
Yes. Yes. And staying together thinking that this is maybe the best thing, even though you're miserable and your spouse is miserable and the kid's miserable, is not in the best interest of the child. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let's go on here to someone else. This is Urbana, line two. Hello.
Hi. I was just calling to recommend to the grandfather-to-be, perhaps a very good thermometer would be a good thing to put in a medicine cabinet.
And what kind of thermometer?
I digital. My ear thermometer. They're about $40, $45, electronic ear thermometer.
Okay.
And I've had very good success with that, and I just think it's a great gift. I received one as a gift, and it was just a great gift for a baby shower or just for a new parent.
I would differ with you slightly. I think I would recommend a digital thermometer instead of an ear thermometer.
Oh, it is digital, but you put it in the ear?
No, this one you stick in, orifice, either the mouth or the other end.
Oh, okay.
They're a little bit more accurate. Ear thermometers aren't bad. They suffer some from accuracy.
Okay.
But absolutely, definitely not the mercury thermometer, the old glass mercury thermometer now.
Right. No, and a lot of people still have those, so it's a good way to, giving someone a new thermometer, help them get that old one out of the...
The other advantage of the digital thermometer is they're about the price of the old mercury thermometer. You can get those for less than $10 now.
Oh, great. Okay. Well, then something like that.
But something electronic.
Right. It's a great gift.
All right. Very good.
All right. Thanks.
Thank you. Let's talk with someone in Champaign. This is line three. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I was hoping that the pediatrician would have some ideas to help me with my reluctant eater. He's a 9-year-old boy, and I've been waiting since he was a toddler for this sort of reluctant eating to pass and for him to, you know, start eating like a, you know, like a normal boy.
Yeah, and that probably won't happen till 14 or 15.
Oh, okay. That's bad news.
And when you were gonna, when you will regret, as your food bill goes up exponentially, you will regret, yeah, you will remember these days fondly. I guess, what's he not eating? You know, and I think, he's growing well, I presume.
Yes. He's had blood work checked, and he seems to be going fine.
Okay.
But I've tried everything I can think of. He seems to have a problem with texture as well as taste.
Okay.
And he would like to just drink, you know, 4 or 5 huge big glasses of cold milk every day and not have to chew anything at all. And it's not only that he wants to fill up with candies and pizza and things like that. If he goes to a birthday party, he doesn't eat the cake, he doesn't eat the ice cream. It's not like he just wants sweet things. He just doesn't want to chew. So,
And he's had regular dental visits.
Yes.
So there's
nothing
wrong
with
his
teeth.
Okay. And there's nothing wrong with his jaw, with his occlusion, with his bite.
As far as I know, the dentist has never said there's any problem with the way his teeth and jaws work.
Okay. How about speech?
Speech is fine. He's got
speech is fine.
Yeah. He doesn't seem to be a mechanical problem at all.
Okay.
I've tried, you know, cracking down and saying, this is what the family's eating for dinner. Either eat this or go hungry. That doesn't work. I've tried making only the things that he does eat, which is sort of hard or firm, dry things. Nothing with sauce, no mashed potato, no... And everything has to be separate on the plate. Only... I made sure he's had a vegetable every single day of his life. Well, not every single day of his life. Much as I can. But the only thing he will eat is raw carrots.
Okay.
So I think, well, that's good, he's having a vegetable. I'm trying to make the point he's got to eat vegetables. If he eats the same vegetable every day of his life for 8 years, you know, that's better than no vegetable. But I'm thinking, is there something, you know, maybe this, I just need to hang in there for another couple of years and this will pass over, or maybe there's something I can try.
No, I think you've tried everything. You know, you've asked him for his food preferences. You've let him help with his own personal menu, and I think you've done the best you can. It is kind of disconcerting that he just likes, that he'd like to live on milk, because milk, you know, milk is a good food, but it's certainly iron deficient, but you've already had his blood work checked out, so we don't have any problem with anemia, so he must be supplementing enough iron from elsewhere.
Well, that's because when we have a meal, I sit there and say, you have to have another bite, you're not excused, you have eaten this, and it's a nightmare. It's not a fun, family, relaxing dinner activity at all.
You know, I think what I'd say is back off, you know, because you're not, again, mealtime's becoming a battle. And this may be somewhat behavioral, that he's learned that he can ring your bell with his eating. So it may be time to end the battle and say, you know, you're 9 years old now. I've instructed you in proper nutrition and healthy food eating, and you're just going to this is what's on the table. I am not running a restaurant here. Yes, if you don't like liver and onions, that's cool. Go ahead and make yourself a peanut butter and jelly sandwich. But I am not going to fight.
He's never eaten a peanut butter and jelly sandwich in his life.
Okay.
Not even if I begged him to.
That's okay. I hate peanut butter myself.
I think he will revert to an all-milk diet. If I hand it over to him, that's what I'm afraid of. He'll say, terrific. I don't want to eat this stuff. You keep making me eat this stuff. All I'm going to do is drink 0.5 gallon of milk a day. And if he did that, how long would I let that go before I said, fine, we're back to the battle?
Yeah, I think you might limit his milk. You know, you can have 3 glasses of milk a day, and then you fill up with whatever's around the house. But I'm not going to battle you anymore because, quite frankly, I'm not accomplishing anything with the battle. And the whole family's the whole family's not looking forward to mealtime. And I think I'd probably end the battle. It might limit his milk intake. And I think all the studies show that these kids do, that almost all kids, if you leave them alone, will be nutritionally fine.
I'm sorry. I'm afraid I'm going to have to jump in here just because I'm way past the time and we're going to have to stop. Good luck to the caller. Maybe she can call us back next month and tell us how it's going, and we can talk some more. But for the moment, we're going to have to stop.
Okay.
Dr. Robert Bochak, our guest, he's here every Thursday. We talk about children's health. Thank you.
Thank you.